has won it. They stream out of the dugout. Yeah. Rollins ball near third. This game is over.
Second deck walk-off home run. Grand slam, Bryce Harper.
That's what I call hitting season.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode 537. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter, at John Stolness. Coming up, we'll give you the latest update on the labor talks as they're going on down in Florida. It looks like they're going to be talking every day this week as we are hurtling towards a soft deadline, I guess, of February 28th to get a negotiation finished so that Major League Baseball can lift the lockout and we can start the season on time, but we'll give you the latest on whether or not any movement was made towards each other at the labor talks. There was a couple interesting articles this week that we're going to talk about. Todd Zielecki wrote up a profile of a new front office hire that the Phillies made away from the Rays earlier this offseason. Jason Stark wrote a piece, an interesting piece for The Athletic, talking about what if baseball eliminated the shift, what that would do, and the Pecota projections are out. Surprisingly bullish on the Phillies, as far as I'm concerned. So we'll talk about all that stuff coming up here on this episode of Hittin' Season. Liz not with us tonight. She's out and about taking the week off and enjoying some much needed vacation time. So joining me this week, we'll do a show just the two of us. Justin Clue, of course, from Baseball Prospectus and The Dirty Inning and Continued Success. Follow him on Twitter at Justin_Clue. Justin, what's up, bud?
I feel like everybody probably is aware of this, but this week we will be reaching the two-year anniversary of the revelation of the new-look Philly Fanatic who walked into the team's
I didn't realize.
Spring training home opener. It feels like an entire era has passed with that Fanatic as the Fanatic, and that the old one is back after less than apparently 2 years. That struck me as wild that only that amount of time had passed.
Yeah. Did they say they were going to bring back the old Fanatic looks?
Oh man, did I make that up too? I was
pretty
sure.
No, I don't know. I don't know. You probably are right. I haven't been following this as closely, but I don't remember seeing anything where they said they're going to get rid of the blue stars around the eyes and all the other stuff that they did to kind of make it look like a faux fanatic, I guess.
Back in November, the report came out, including in the Inquirer, where they said they can use the original Fanatic, according to how the settlement ended up. They can go back to it. So
I just wonder if they will, unless their pride is such that it's like, no, this was the Fanatic, or maybe it's just a pain in the rear end to, redo the costume or whatever. I don't know. I don't know what's involved in changing a mascot costume around, but yes, I will be. Of all the things we've been worried about here this offseason, what the Fanatic's going to look like this year, it hasn't been on the radar.
Doesn't it feel like everything is a distraction from everything else? Like it's just all part of the same big conspiracy.
Yes, well, I'm distracting you from stuff you want to do, and I'm sure you're distracting me, and we're all distracting each other on Twitter all the time. So, yeah. Well, let's talk about the labor stuff going on down in Florida, Justin. There's not a whole lot to report on other than the fact that these two sides are meeting. They met for a longer period of time here on Monday. According to Evan Drellich at The Athletic, he said that the sides met in two separate sessions Monday for about 1 hour, 10 minutes at first, followed by 3 hours. I love how I use the word caucusing separately, like they're members of congressional leadership. Then again, for about 45 minutes after that. So that part of it is good, I suppose, the fact that they had a meeting that lasted longer than 15 minutes and that they are meeting again every day this week as they try to get a deal hammered out. But if you look at what actual movement we've seen in terms of the offers, there's not a whole lot there, which makes me wonder, like, why would these meetings take as long as they are if nobody's really moving in any direction? So the owners proposed to add $5 million more to the new bonus pool that they're going to create for pre-arbitration players, which would bring the total to $20 million. The league also offered to they want to create a partial draft lottery just for the first four picks in the draft, in the amateur draft. That was an increase from their earlier proposal of 3. Major League Baseball also withdrew a proposal that got floated earlier this week where they were looking to reduce minor league roster sizes and to limit the number of times a player can be optioned to 5. The league could unilaterally attempt to reduce minor league roster sizes in future seasons, but they don't seem to be wanting to do that just now. The players are asking, so the owners went up from went up $5 million to $20 million, Justin. So I guess that's a little bit of movement towards the players. But the players are asking for $115 million. And they want that $115 million to be distributed to 150 players who they think should be arbitration eligible. Major League Baseball wants to keep the Super 2 number down to around 30 players, which would mean a much smaller bonus pool. So there's still a big gap there in terms of the amount of money and how to pay younger players. And then the players are asking for the top 8 picks in the draft to be determined by lottery, not the top 4, because they believe that the more picks you have that are determined by a lottery, the less likely teams are to tank during the course of the regular season. So the next proposal, the union is set to make its next proposals on Tuesday. There was no discussion, and this is really where the rubber is going to meet the road on the competitive balance tax. That's still the big sticking point, you know, and that's there hasn't been any real discussion or movement on that other than the owners saying they want to increase the penalties without raising the number at all, which is a non-starter and bad for baseball. So they're meeting. That's great. They're not really moving towards each other. That's not great, Justin. What do you think?
Well, I feel like the length of the meeting doesn't matter as much. The fact that they, you know, they didn't leave today, the reporters had to figure out if this was just like a intermission between meetings or if they were like done. Like if they meet for 15 minutes, then, I mean, my understanding is that's them going into a room being like, this is where we're at. This is where we're at. And then when they separate, they go to their own little camps and they talk about what they want to do next. That's still negotiating. And like when you sit in a room for an hour and 10 minutes, you know, you ask what they're doing in there. Well, they're negotiating, presumably. I mean, you know, they're debating, they're arguing, they're making their arguments. I just feel like this process has been composed almost entirely of bad faith arguments. So it must be really tough to negotiate when you don't even feel like the person you're negotiating with is even genuinely negotiating yet. I mean, you mentioned those figures. MLB is like trying to make it such a give that they went up to 20 million when they know what the players want is far beyond that. So it doesn't feel like a real offer. And it mirrors a lot of their behavior throughout this entire process. I mean, one encouraging thing from this recent cycle is that clearly Major League Baseball was attempting to splinter the players a bit by having them screw over minor leaguers who, again, don't have a union, who right. don't have a seat at the table during these negotiations. And they didn't buckle, you know, not yet at least. It is somewhere where, like, it's a raw underbelly, I think, for the union, because it's somewhere where maybe they could give and be like, well, it's, you know, we're not minor leaguers, so, you know, we don't really have to worry about this.
Right.
But, you know, that's what was encouraging about this. They didn't do that. So it's seeing the league repeatedly try to attack from different angles. And the, you know, the players' goal in these negotiations this round for the CBA and everything was that they were going to stand up for everything they lost in the last mm-hmm. one. And that requires unity. That's why it's a union. So yeah. Like standing fast the way they have and just protecting each other, you know, that is encouraging. However, I don't think it's super encouraging for the I just want baseball back party.
Yeah.
So that's where you're going to run into trouble. I mean, you know, that's where it's like, well, if they're still this far apart, yeah, it's good that the players are holding strong because, it you know, it just indicates they know what the situation is. They are aware of how they're going to be able to gain any leverage here is by remaining together on this. But that, you know, the fans kind of get the raw end of the deal there where we don't get the immediate satisfaction of seeing baseball come back. The whole point of this, though, is that the long-term benefits that this will be for that this could be for the players and the compromises that are hopefully, you know, a little more in their favor this time is going to entice, you know, better baseball, happier baseball players, more people wanting to play baseball, more Kyler Murray's not having to pick immediately the NFL when they reach that point in their careers. Just stuff like that. You know, this is supposed to be a long-term positive, but hey, you know, it's not like I'm famous for thinking in the long term. So I understand people that are more just like, I want baseball to be back.
I was thinking about this earlier today, and the public relations mistake I think Major League Baseball made by imposing the lockout. I still don't understand why they did it, really, because they're losing the argument, I think. It seems to me they're losing the argument among fans who care about whose fault this is. Because, again, like you said, there's a select group of fans who don't care whose fault this is. They see it's millionaires versus billionaires, and I just want my baseball back. You guys work this out. And to be sure, there is a compromise that could be reached among reasonable people if you had reasonable people on both sides who wanted a deal, who aren't trying to win the negotiations, but who want to work on a deal together. And my sense is that the players' union is more likely to do that than the owners, that there's more of a sense on the player side to give a little bit than there is on the owner side. At least that's been the history of labor negotiations when it comes to these two sides. But I think Major League Baseball the players union can point to Major League Baseball and say, you guys are the reason the season's going to start late. You locked us out. I know what Rob Manfred's rationalization was. He didn't want to give the players the control over starting a season and then walking in the middle of a season. But in that type of a situation, I think one of the reasons why the players really took it on the chin in 94 is because the players went on strike. And for people who aren't really dialed into the negotiations, for people who don't know what the competitive balance tax for...
There's people who think the players are on strike right now.
Like, there are, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure there are, yeah, because you just see, you know, there's no baseball being played. Why are the players on strike? For sure. I'm sure there is a large section of people out there who think that. Nevertheless, it is the owners who have locked out the players. It's the owners who have stopped free agency and who have stopped trades, who've scrubbed every player's name off of their websites and everything. And I think that gives gives the union strength here. I think that gives the union an excuse to hold fast, to hold out a little bit longer, because in terms of the public relations battle, seems to me the owners take it on the chin in this particular situation more than the players do. And I hope it leads to compromise. I hope the owners are saying to themselves, yeah, we're going to be held responsible for this, so we need to do a little bit more maybe than we had planned on doing or we have done in the past. I mean,
but what does an owner being held responsible even look like? I mean,
just that they get yelled at in the press, that they get yelled at by fans, and they're the ones who get the finger pointed at them.
Yeah, but like, why would that? Why would that matter to them? I'm not trying to like come down on you here. What does that look like? Like, okay, do people really think there's going to be some kind of mass boycott? No, like people are so desperate for baseball to come back because they want to go to baseball games. They want to go back and spend their money at the ballpark and be baseball fans again. So I don't really see like how often is a fan going to see a restaurant recognize an owner in the window and like bang on the window and yell at them. Like, I just don't see that's the scenario where an owner is actually accountable really, really happening. And I think that's why, honestly, their PR just feels so lazy. Like, it really just feels it's some of the most infuriating moments from this process have been because the league side, the commissioner's side, the ownership side really communicates as though they think people are really stupid. Like, that they don't know what's going on. That, like, you know, you saw it from day one when Rob Manfred's little letter appeared on MLB.com. And like you mentioned, they scrubbed all the player images off. And in that letter, he framed things, not just like spinning them to be favorable to his side, but just saying things incorrectly, you know, mm-hmm. lying in some cases, yeah. Especially in terms of like this lockout and why it's happening. You know, they're saying, oh, well, we have to do this. They didn't have to do it. And like from day one, you knew that was going to be the tone, that like, you people just don't understand. And then at the end of the day, why do they need us to understand? Like, what they're doing is just for them. So they don't need us to understand. And I don't see a situation where they really get held accountable. I just don't.
I think it's not so much that the owners get held accountable, although I do think we underestimate how badly owners want to be loved by the fans of the teams they own.
That's true. I do always forget how desperate that is. And I mentioned it before, I think, but yeah. Rob Maines from Baseball Perspective said there's two reasons somebody becomes an owner of a baseball team. One is because it's a bust-proof investment, and the other is for like just the local notoriety, the fame, yeah. The celebrity, the little minor celebrity of it, you know, getting guys to call you sir and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, going out and hanging out with the Fandemic crew, as I know you guys have busted John Middleton's chops for that, deservedly so, a number of different times. So they don't want to be ridiculed in the paper. They don't want to be, you know, have their reputations dragged in the, you know, I say the paper, the internet. But I do think too, players really care about how fans perceive them. And if the heat isn't on the players, that's kind of more what I mean, is like the heat's not on the players in this particular situation. At least it doesn't seem to me. In everything that I read about this labor stoppage and that I see online, it's the players are not the ones taking the heat. If players are the ones getting pounded by baseball fans, by the press, by whoever is talking about this labor stoppage, they're more likely to cave. They're more likely to give away the farm quicker or give away more of it than they want to. Whereas if the blame is shifting to the owners, you're right, they may not get hurt in their bottom line, but it might just take some of the pressure off of the players from feeling like they have to come to a deal at all costs.
Yeah, and you know, as was pointed out when this began, this is the first baseball labor dispute situation that's happening in the age of social media, where people are a little more, you know, within arm's reach. You know, like that you can more directly yell at someone, as opposed to before, where it was, you know, like I was saying before, the odds of running into someone in a restaurant from these right. labor negotiations. In this case, yeah, you can just tweet at a player you're mad at, and you know they can ignore that or not. But you know that's still like the anger currency that gets passed on at this point. Yeah. So yeah, I would agree with you.
So that's the latest on the labor situation right now, guys. Again, not a whole lot of movement one way or the other. There are some small movements moving back and forth. And like we said, the biggest positive to come out of this whole thing is that it certainly appears as though both sides recognize that the sands are ticking through the hourglass ever faster here if they want to start the season on time on March 31st. But it seems like a huge chasm to try and have to cross here with just 4 or 5 days of steady negotiating. But we'll see how things roll here towards as the week goes along, and we'll be continuing to give you updates on the midweek Hit and Season podcast and the other podcasts that we're going to have up during the course of the week. We'll step away. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about Pecota loving the Phillies rotation and what would happen if baseball eliminated the shift. We'll get into all that stuff coming up next here on Hit and Season. And we're back on Hit and Season. So the Phillies still have a ton of holes on their team, right? I mean, we know that they need outfielders. They still have kind of an unsettled situation on the left side of the infield. I think they still need a couple of viable relief pitchers that you can really count on. This is an incomplete team as we sit here recording in the evening on February 21st. But that doesn't stop the projection machines out there from powering on and using all of the RAM at their disposal to spit out some projections on what they think teams are going to do this year. And the Pecota projections absolutely love the Phillies this year. Now, when I say that, they're not picking the Phillies to win like 95 games or anything like that, but it was a surprisingly high win total for the Phillies, according to Pecota. They have the Phillies right now finishing second in the National League East, as currently constructed, at 86.5 wins behind the Mets, who I think they had at 90 wins, which makes sense given all of the additions that the Mets have made this offseason. Although, again, when you're talking about the New York Mets, you know, you just wait for the implosion with glee and from the bushes and watch with amusement. But where this is really coming down to, Justin, is Pecota loves the Phillies' starting rotation. Baseball Prospectus, which is what the Pecota projections, where they come from, they use a system called wins above... What is WARP? Wins above...
Pitcher?
I mean, I just flew right out of my head.
Wins above... Really, wins above replacement.
Now I got to look it up.
I was just reading this.
Wins above replacement player. That should
player.
Be easy.
Yeah, I know this is simple. Yeah.
Why couldn't I do that? Wins above replacement. Everybody listening to the podcast is like, it's player, idiot. It's player. Say player. It's wins above replacement player, dummy. Anyway, they predict that each Philadelphia starter will average more than two WARP, wins above replacement player, this season. Only the Mets starters are projected to average more WARP, 2.4 per pitcher in the National League East. So it's kind of funny that they really do love Zach Wheeler, although they do see Zach Wheeler taking a step back, 3 ERA in 183 innings. Aaron Nola, they have him really rebounding to a 2.89 ERA. Ranger Suarez, 3.46 ERA. Zach Eflin, 3.57. Kyle Gibson, 4.46. I mean, that doesn't sound awesome, but they think that the Phillies rotation is really going to be the strength of this team, and the ERAs seem like reasonable projections there. What are your thoughts on how Pecota is looking at the Phillies so far here in 2022?
Well, it feels like stability is an easier thing to project. And I mean, late last year, it became a quiet little subplot for this team that, you know, with the acquisition of Kyle Gibson, you can almost see what this rotation is going to look like next year. And then you can start theorizing things like, well, Aaron Nola will look better and Zach Wheeler will stay good. And, you know, we saw what happened with Ranger Suarez and how great he looked by the end of the year. So suddenly there's this like formidable 1-2-3 at the top of the Phillies bullpen or rotation. And Baseball Prospectus actually published a story last October asking, is the Phillies rotation secretly good? Kind of saying a lot of the same things with using ERA and DRA and, you know, how the difference in those two stats and why defensive runs allowed is better than FIP because FIP blends a lot of statistics together and thinks of them as the same thing or as the only things a pitcher can control. Defensive runs allowed accounts for catcher quality, as Liz Rocher was explaining to me earlier today. So yeah. It's a more accurate statistic, and that's where you had guys like Nola, whose value did not come through in earned run average, as right. You plainly saw. But there was this sort of back burner statistic showing that, like, okay, he is doing some stuff well. That shows, that obviously makes him a bounce back candidate. So with that coming from the Baseball Prospectus machine, now going back and reading this, in hindsight, it's not at all surprising that Pecota would target the Phillies as having this rotation that has this great chance of putting a strong 1-2-3. And frankly, if Kyle Gibson is your number five starter and he's got a 4.46 ERA and that's the worst you got, that's a pretty good rotation. Like that is. That's that again, it's another year where that could be a good enough rotation to win the NL East. And I mean, how many teams can brag that they have like five starters like that that are pitching that much at this point? Which brings me to my next point. That they're projecting all five of these guys to pitch 100 innings. The game has changed in even just the past couple of years. That that number, like I went back and I was like, this is something that people are latching on to. When's the last time this happened? Because you almost think it must have been a while. It was just 2018. Nola, Arrieta, Pivetta, Velasquez, and Eflin all pitched over 100 innings. Obviously, you're throwing in the at least two wins above replacement player aspect of it. That's I think, the differentiator here. Guys who pitch a while and are also effective. Because they also did it in 2016, and they also did it in 2014. And in 2012, they actually had six starting pitchers who pitched over 100 innings, but that's because you still have the lingering effects of still having some old guard guys there who were still close to the height of their powers. So that, but it's also just telling you how much the game has changed in that like a six-inning start is considered a deep start now. You're not seeing as many complete games, especially a guy like Nola, who, you know, they will occasionally find reasons to be like, well, we got to protect him a little bit. Like, he's our guy. It was obviously surprising to see 86.5 wins next to the Phillies' name. But when you go into like what they're, whether you like buy into what Baseball Prospectus prioritizes statistically or not, you can go back and see why exactly their projections put the Phillies there because of how much value they attribute to their rotation.
I think it's interesting looking at the inning totals. You did mention they were all over 100 innings, but I think the inning numbers for Wheeler and Nola are lower than where I would expect them to be. They have
Nola's
Zach
got
Wheeler.
Two different 200 inning seasons already, at least. He's managed to do that a couple of times.
Right, and they're projecting 166 innings for him, which would mean he's missing gosh, probably a good 7 or 8 starts. Maybe not quite that many, but yeah, about 7 or 8 starts probably. Because if you think he's going to probably give you 210 innings or something like that in a healthy season. Zach Wheeler, too, was obviously a workhorse last year, and they have him at 183 innings, and maybe that's better for him, too, because he did pitch a ton last year. But Ranger Suarez, they only have him pitching 132 innings this year. Zach Eflin only at 106. So, I mean, basically...
That would be easily a career high for Suarez, by the way, because I checked that, too, because I was like, oh, he hasn't been around that long, and he's young. The most innings he's ever thrown was 106 innings, and that was last year. Okay, so 132 would be a jump for him.
Yeah, that would be a decent-sized jump for him. I mean, I was expecting maybe something in the 150 to 160 range, but that might be – that my eyes might be a little bigger than my stomach based on what he did last year. But there are going to be – based on those innings numbers, there are going to have to be other starting pitchers that step up. Either that or the bullpen is throwing a bunch of innings, which means you got to really fix that thing. But, yeah, I think it's nice. I think it's good to see that there's a projection system out there that really loves what the Phillies have in the starting rotation. I think it is going to probably be the best thing about them this year. If Zach Wheeler and Aaron Nola, Zach Wheeler doesn't have to do what he did last year in order for him to be a top of the rotation starter. But Aaron Nola does have to do better. I know the deserved run average certainly was better for Aaron Nola last year than his earned run average. But again, just the eye test with Aaron Nola told you something was wrong. Something was a little off. Like he didn't have it in a lot of his outings where he couldn't pitch deep, and he did struggle second and third time through the order. So there was something there. I think one of the things we've seen this offseason with Aaron Nola is looking at numbers, kind of now that the eye test fades over time. You forget what you've been watching every 5 days once you've had an entire winter to think about other things. We have to remember, too, with Aaron Nola, yes, looking at the numbers, he probably did deserve a little better than he got last year in terms of ERA, but that he earned that earned run average.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we watched it. We watched it in real time. We watched him earn that earned run average. And so there are things he has to work on. He has to execute better with two strikes. And his deserved run average may not change a whole lot if he doesn't. But, the deserved run average may stay the same, and the ERA may come down if he does. But the deserved run average is good to look at. I think it's a fair way to judge a pitcher and really take a look at the things he can control. But... you know, last year he wasn't good in a lot of his starts, no matter what the DRA was.
I think that's a stat that purpose is for exactly how we're using it now. It's a great hindsight stat. It's a great way to see if a guy who struggled in one way was at all effective in another way. But yeah, in the middle of the 2021 season, if we were watching Aaron Nola, you know, give up 2-strike home runs for, you know, 3 straight starts as he would, and then someone jumped in and raised a finger in the air and was like, yeah, but his DRA, I don't give a crap at that point. Like, he just gave up a home run like with 2 outs left to the Padres in a game that was going really well, and then he fell apart. Like, no. Like, that's none of that. That doesn't matter right now. It's good for figuring out what to project about a guy in the future, which is exactly like Nola is a perfect candidate for that. So if you want to be encouraged at all, it's a good number to look at. But I also don't blame people for being like, I don't care, just show me. Like, go out there, make a bunch of good starts, go deep, stop giving up home runs, execute with 2 strikes so that you can get guys out, and let's just get back to that first before we start, you know, crowning guys for background statistics. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about the Jason Stark article in The Athletic that appeared on Monday, talking about what would happen if the shift went away. And I think it was an interesting read. I went into it thinking, absolutely, ban the shift. It'll make life better for everyone, especially for left-handed hitters, and it's something that baseball needs to do. I hate the shift. I've always hated the shift. I think, you know, I just remember Ryan Howard having one ground ball eaten after another by hitting into the shift. But, you know, a lot of those ground balls that sneak through the right side, they're not hit that hard. They probably don't deserve to be hits. I don't mind so much those things getting gobbled up, as in the article, Joey Gallo was talking about those line drives that left-handed hitters pull to the outfield that are caught by the second baseman or the shortstop standing on the outfield grass. Those are the ones that really annoy people. They last year, and I didn't realize they were doing this in Double A and in the Atlantic League, they were trying some different things with defensive shifting. They were preventing infielders from playing on the outfield grass for half a season, and then they would switch, and they would put a rule in place that says two fielders can only be on one side of the second base bag at a time. So they found, the article is interesting in that they found that when they put these rules into place, the line drives and the grounders up the middle that hitters say that they really hate getting gobbled up by the shift, that didn't change all that much when they moved everybody back to where they're supposed to be. It's actually not as many of those hits are getting gobbled up by the shift as it would seem, as one would think. The biggest issue was having the infielders on the outfield grass. It was basically playing four outfielders, because you're penalizing these left-handed hitters, and really, I guess, other hitters as well, when they hit line drives, doubles, you know, balls that should be falling in for singles and doubles, they're getting penalized for that. And I'm all for getting rid of shifting, Justin. And I think what we saw in the article, too, was that there are a lot of people in front offices who are willing to take a tool away from some of their analytics people if it's going to improve the game. Understanding that the NFL and the NBA has made rules changes over the years with the three-point line and defensive, zone defense in the NBA and all that kind of stuff. The NFL changes its rules. Just, I'm amazed they haven't gone to five downs yet. They change every year. So, I don't know. I thought the piece, it had some kind of mixed findings in there. The numbers, the data says the shift is eating hits up, but then when they looked at stuff from Double A and the Atlantic League, the results were a little bit mixed. They're a little bit hard to kind of pull out and get anything real from them, with the exception of the infielders on the outfield grass. Doing away with that really would have made a big difference in those particular leagues. What did you think of the article and about defensive shifting in baseball? How badly do you think, does it need to go away, or are you a fan of it?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a fan of shifting, but I guess I'm generally, it's tough not to look at it like, okay, so the game changed. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, like there was a strategy in place that front offices decided to employ, or like, you know, a couple of them did, and then a bunch of others followed suit, where they were like, look, we have the kind of data that tells us exactly, theoretically, where this guy's going to hit the ball, because we know where he hits it most of the time. And if we just put a guy there, why wouldn't we just put a guy there?
Right.
And like eliminate that. And so you think, yeah, as baseball evolves, because it is, you know, it's as fluid as it's always been. You know, there's a reason we have a dead ball era. There's a reason we have a steroid era. There's a reason we know guys used to steal more. Guys used to bunt more. The game has changed. Like, it has a bunch of different tools, buttons, and levers you can press. And at different points in its history, people have more feverishly hit certain buttons other than other ones. And in this case, the shift is really is benefiting the defense, and guys like Joey Gallo, guys like Freddie Freeman, who are quoted in the article, are getting, you know, they're the ones getting dinged for this, because as they explain, and this is kind of my point, that like there is no take to that give on the offensive side. Like, if you're talking about hitters like that, they're not going to be able to suddenly just be able to hit the ball wherever they want. Like, that's not what they're doing up there.
Right.
Sometimes they're just swinging to make contact, and they don't know where the ball's going to go. But
right, one of the players were like, you know, the fans say to us, well, just hit the ball the other way. It's like, do you have any idea how hard that is?
I mean, I stood in a batting cage once with 100-mile-an-hour pitches coming at me, and I was like, I can't even see the ball. I can't even begin to know when to swing. Like, this is absurd. Can you imagine, like, yeah, adjusting speed and movement and everything? That's absurd.
Not everybody is Tony Gwynn. I mean,
right.
And these guys like Joey Gallo, like Ryan Howard, I mean, they've learned to hit a certain way their whole lives for decades. They're not going to suddenly start, you know, bing, hitting balls the other way. That's just, you can't expect a player to do that.
I did kind of expect, like, once it reached its most ridiculous point with Ryan Howard, I did kind of expect him to learn to bunt, you know, just as,
yeah,
like, hey, look, man, it's clearly the years are, you know, they're going by quickly, and you're closer to the end of your career than the beginning. They're going to employ this obnoxious tactic on you every time. Why not just do, I love when Bryce Harper does it, because it's effective. It's exactly, like, that's the counterbalance, but the problem is it's just not tenable. It's just not realistic to suddenly have all these slugging left-handers bunting down the third base line. They're going to get hurt. doing it wrong. You know, it's bunting. It doesn't automatically mean a hit, even though, again, with the amount of space you have on that side, kind of does. But I guess that's the problem, is that this was a tactic that was employed that didn't have a countermeasure to balance it back out, because that's, you know, that's what you need. And I think that's why it's now in the hands of, like, the league to be like, okay, now we have to, this was all technically legal, we have to change the rules so it's not quite legal in order to work it out. And I was a little curious what you thought about, like, the front office quotes they have in there, like you mentioned, where they're like, yeah, you know, we're good enough at this to know what is and isn't a benefit to us, but we're also, you know, we're also aware enough that the sport has to remain entertaining. So if they take it away, you know, we'll learn to live without it. And I mean, that is kind of their job. Like, the one guy was like, yeah, we just present me with the rules and I will, it is my job to learn how to play within those rules, find all the advantages within those rules that I can pass on to my team and help us win games. But, like, do you, how genuine do you think that is? Like, how many executives do you really feel are sitting there like, yeah, but what about the good of baseball? Like, I guess on the one hand, it is their job. It's the industry they live in. If people are tuning away, then, like, everybody eventually gets hurt by that. But I don't know. It seems genuine, but it also just seems like a sentiment that's you wouldn't necessarily – I think Stark was surprised by it, too, because you wouldn't necessarily expect it.
Yeah, because you've invested all this money in these analytics departments to give you all that data, and now you're just going to say, well, you know, it actually makes the game worse. I don't know, maybe we've reached kind of a breaking point with some of this stuff, where people do understand that the game needs to have more action in it. You know, there has to be a little bit more going on, you know, seeing hitters hit with for a 220 average when they could be hitting for a 260 average because of defensive shifting, if that is in fact a real thing. You know, that's a problem for the game. You know, you don't, nobody comes to the ballpark nobody comes to the ballpark to see outs, but, you know, that is a part of the game. It's, you know, and sometimes watching an out is really spectacular if it's a great play. So I guess what I'm saying is I do believe it, I think. And I think there is something about the aesthetic of the game, and I think the fact that you have these teams investing in analytics so much, defensive shifting is not the only thing they're doing. They still get their money's worth out of these guys, right? So if they decide to do away with defensive shifting, they'll figure out another way to use these numbers and all of these guys from Google and Yale to their advantage. So I think it's real. I think it's legit. I do think a lot of these executives see the game and realize, you know, it's not like owners. Owners just care about the bottom line. I do think, like, GMs, you know, and other team executives actually like the game. You know, they do love the game. They want the game to be the best it can be. At least maybe that's my pie-eyed optimism. I don't know, but nobody's ever really accused me of that. But I don't know. I feel like if you're a fan of baseball, and most big league executives, I think, are fans of baseball, if there's something you can change, if there's something you can do, understanding that the NBA and the NFL make rules changes all the time for the betterment of the game, whether or not it's a competitive advantage or disadvantage. And that's the other thing, too. There was a time when only a handful of teams shifted. Now everybody does it. So there's not a real big competitive advantage to shifting anymore, because everybody does it. So if everybody stops doing it, it doesn't really hurt or help one team over another, I don't think.
Yeah, and the other point that Stark makes in the piece is, I think, pretty accurate in that it's already irreversibly changed. Even if you get rid of shifting, the game has evolved the game already. So if Rob Manfred's goal is to get the game back to what it was like when he was 12, it's already too late for that. Like, that's over. That's not coming back. So, like, that's another important aspect of this, is that, you know, part of the clamoring to change it is that there's people out there who have, you know, obviously baseball's fan base has gotten older, and this just, you know, this is just appears obnoxious. I mean, it's obnoxious to me too as well, when you're just, you know, watching a guy you want to see get a hit, you know, a hitter who your team has brought in to be an exciting player, and they're just getting smothered. Yeah, it's just not the same. So I do think, yeah, that this is something that needs to be addressed, but people also need to realize that just because it gets addressed doesn't mean it's going to go back to the way it was, because it won't.
Right. It's not going to be a game where we have lots of singles and stolen bases again. You know, I just...
It's, not yet, anyway. But then, like, years from now, some team will be like, we're getting really aggressive with base stealing. And it'll be, like, this cool thing. Like, did you know you could steal bases in baseball? And, like, right. It'll be a whole movement. Yeah. And, yeah.
I am waiting for that. That'll be a lot of fun because stolen bases are one of the things that I miss most about the game. It's one of the few things where you have just a lot of action. All kinds of dramatic things can happen when players try to steal. All right, last thing before we get out of here, I thought it was an interesting story. I know this guy that the Phillies hired from the Tampa Bay Rays, we talked about it when it first happened because we're like, oh my gosh, they hired somebody from the Rays. And this is the sense I think that most Phillies fans had when the Phillies went out and they brought aboard Ani Colombi to the Phillies from the Tampa Bay Rays. He was in their front office and part of their player development system and part of the club's research in the club's research department. He was brought in November. He's just 28. My goodness, I'm old. He was brought in November to be an assistant general manager in charge of the Phillies research departments. And he's one of those guys who's going to be really heading how the Phillies use data throughout the organization. You know, we see what the Rays do every year with their self-imposed poverty and how they are able to field a 90 to 95 win team every single year without spending a dime. Luckily, the Phillies are a team that spends significantly more than the Rays. And I know that all Phillies fans are thinking, great, he's going to do for the Phillies what he did for the Rays. And obviously, he's aware of that. And that's one of the things that Todd Zielecki noted in his piece is that he's aware that he thinks that a lot of Phillies fans think, and I think maybe I was guilty of this a little bit too when he was first brought here, that he's going to bring some of the Tampa Bay magic formula to Philadelphia and that we're going to be just like Tampa Bay and developing all these great young pitching prospects and bullpen guys. One guy after another is going to come out throwing 98, 99 with wipeout sliders, and it's probably not going to work out like that. But I guess, I don't know, what a reasonable I don't even know that there's expectations you can have for this guy. He's a front office guy who's going to be helping with research and development. Are we just making too much out of things like this, Justin?
Tell me it's a labor stoppage without telling me it's a labor stoppage that we are having this conversation. But no,
we need stuff to write about talk about.
We definitely talked about that. I like that this was addressed to him, that they were like, hey, you're from the Rays. What's that about? And he had to just be like, yeah, look, it's really an individual thing. And, you know, I'll say that's... Yeah, that I totally agree with what he's saying. I mean, you're right. People freaked out that there was someone from the Rays coming to the Phillies. I'm pretty sure David Murphy wrote like a full column saying like the Phillies need to hire everybody from the Rays that they can. Everybody.
Right.
And
right.
It's not like that's it's a good thing to get people from a successful program to come to your program and presumably make it better. You know, that way you don't have questions like, huh, so this GM used to work for the Angels and no one else. Then the Angels like haven't been good for a really long time. So what are we doing here? Like, this guy must have a hell of a plan because as far as his resume goes, not great. But in the case of somebody from the Rays, then it's like, yeah, all right, great. Someone for whom their plans have been working. And we've seen even, you know, from afar the success they've managed to find, you know, yeah, that's good. But as he says in the article, it really matters more about like where you are and, adjusting your evaluation for the players you have and your development for the players you have, not just trying to walk in with a system and force it to work, regardless of who is there. And, you know, I that's kind of what the issue was with Klentak and, you know, a lot of the prevailing philosophies there that wound up being many different philosophies that we now know were contradicting each other. But I feel like that was one of my most common critiques of Matt Klentak was that he never really cared that he was here. It never felt like he really factored in that he was with the Phillies. And I don't mean like, oh, Philadelphia. I mean, just based on the individual team he was on, I'm sure people who worked alongside him would disagree with that, but it was just the general impression I got from outside here. And I just like seeing that philosophy just said out loud that like, look, yeah, look, the Rays system works. And I know that's where I'm from, but now I'm here and this is a different place with different players and I'm going to employ what I do as best as I can. But this is different. It just is. It doesn't mean it's not going to work. It doesn't mean it's definitely going to work. But it's encouraging to have somebody who's coming from a very successful organization bring their expertise to the Phillies. So I think it's a good thing. But, yeah, I think the article did a good job of just kind of addressing that. Like, yeah, the Rays aren't the magical team that, like, everyone who leaves there spreads fairy dust to every subsequent organization. It's gonna be years until we see the fruit of what a lot of these new hires can do.
Yeah, and I remember back when the Cardinals were having all their success, I was all, hire all the Cardinals. And, you know, now it's hire all the Rays. And like you said, it's good to get some ideas. But I think one of the things you talked about on continued success with Liz, and one of the things I mentioned on Hitting Season 2, was Preston Mattingly has to really find what the Phillies way is going to be. And, you know, whatever that is, you know, it's easy to make sarcastic comments about it. It's easy to make jokes about with it, but they need a direction and they need to have confidence in their own analytics department and their own ability to find players and to know what they believe in rather than trying to poach a philosophy from some other team, whether it's a successful team like the Rays or someone else. But I think it's cool that this guy's here. You know, he's a young guy, and, you know, anytime you can add some brain power to your organization, especially one that was in as desperate need for some as the Phillies farm system, that's a good thing. So, all right, Justin, as we wrap up episode 537 here, any thoughts for the fine listeners tonight?
Another anniversary that's, I think, worth noting is that in 1966 this week, February 24th, we almost saw the Braves sign Tom Seaver. If not for the commissioner nullifying the deal because of the rules around signing college players at the time, the Braves almost wound up with Seaver. So then he was declared ineligible. And he was available for any team and then except the Braves. And then, of course, there was a lottery that wound up with, like, Cleveland, the Phillies, the Mets submitting bids to try and get Tom Seaver, and of course the Mets wound up with him. What happened? An interesting collision of NL East histories there, and that we could have had Seaver on the Braves, which I don't know how much better that is than being on the Mets. It's not like we escaped him. But then also for a second, there was a chance he could have been a Philly. But, you know, this is the 60s Phillies, so probably their offer was like, you can pet my dog this afternoon if you come here.
Well, if he'd played for the 60 Phillies, he probably would have broken his spleen.
Yeah, exactly.
Or something. Yeah. And it was also 50 years ago this week, I believe, that the Phillies traded for Steve Carlton, that Rick Wise for Steve Carlton deal in 1972.
Yeah, this is going to be a good year for people who like Steve Carlton anniversaries.
That's true. It was 50 years ago today that Steve Carlton did this. That's right. 1972 was a good time. All right, well, listen, folks, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. Folks, make sure you're checking out the Good Fight podcast feed for all the different stuff we have going on, continued success, the dirty inning, all the good shows we got for you. And over at the Patreon, we got some bonus stuff there too. It's at patreon.com/hittinseason. That's where you can hear Justin and Chris Jones with their podcast Absolutely Hammered. And we've got lots of other good stuff as a bonus for everyone who contributes and chips in to help us out here at the Hittin' Season podcast family. So thank you all for doing that. And thanks everybody for tuning in. Talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.